นะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะพุทธังธัมมังสังฆังนะมัสสามิ Okay, so this today's sutta is called the Anangana Sutta, which means something like freedom from blemishes, freedom from spots, freedom from stains. And I will just dive into it. So if you have any questions, anything, you can always just raise your hand as we go along. We can take the questions as we go along. So please just raise your voice or whatever. Okay, so this is how it goes, the Anangana Sutta. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's Grove, another Pindika's park. There, the Venerable Sariputta addressed the bhikkhus thus. Friends, bhikkhus, friend, they replied. The Venerable Sariputta said this. Friends, there are these four kinds of persons found existing in the world. What for? Here, some person with a blemish does not understand as it actually is thus. I have a blemish in myself. Here, some person with a blemish understands it as it actually is thus. I have a blemish in myself. Here, some person with no blemish does not understand as it actually is thus. I have no blemish in myself. And here some person with no blemish understands it as it actually is thus. I have no blemish in myself. So this is like a very standard kind of teaching in the suttas. This the number of people, four kinds of persons. And this is what you find throughout the Anguttara Nikaya, this kind of enumeration of persons. And there is a whole book in the Abhidhamma called the Pugala Panyati, which is like an enumeration of different types of people, and this is a similar kind of thing here. So this is presumably the origin of the that particular book of the Abhidhamma, the distinguishing of different types of people. It's a very kind of standard teaching device in the suttas. And here, these four types of people are the ones who either understand or don't understand that they either have a blemish or they don't have a blemish. And a blemish here, the meaning of the word blemish is basically any kind of defilement. So the main thing you will see here is that it concerns, of course, things like the five hindrances. Is a very important aspect of those five defilements. But in this particular sutta, the main meaning of the word blemish seems to have to do with a sense of self in particular. In other words, your sense that your pride and your conceit perhaps in connection with a number of different things, particularly your wishes to have a certain status or whatever. And this is also a blemish in Buddhism, because this comes from the idea of a self, and that idea of a self is the one which always leads to problems in the world. That is the one, the underlying thing, and you will see that here, that leads to the five hindrances afterwards, to the desires, to the anger and ill will. And this is what this sutta actually shows, how that sense of self does lead to these desires and problems afterwards, but particularly anger and ill will. So, Daniel, yeah?
Yeah, so here's the blemish, you say, means the sense of self. So, are we talking about the right view of the Aryans? And if so, then wouldn't it be that if they have no blemish, they would know they have no blemish? Is that one of the definitions?
The thing is that in all the suttas, it's not. There is very rarely like a very clear dividing line. It doesn't mean necessarily just one thing. I think in this particular sutta, it has like many different meanings. And one of the meanings is that it has to do with the hindrances. So in that sense, it is, you're free from the hindrances when you attain samadhi, for example. So there's a reference to samadhi. On another level, it's also probably a reference to arya states, in the sense that you have seen, you don't have sakkaya ditti anymore, the view of a self. So in that level also, there's two the different levels here. So, and that is the second thing I wanted to discuss, actually, is what does it mean to understand something as it actually is? And that is the important thing. What does it mean to know that you have a blemish, and not to know that you have a blemish? What does it actually mean? And what it means to understand that, you have to realize that blemishes, in particular things like the five hindrances, have very many different aspects or qualities or strengths to them. And the five hindrances can also be extremely refined. So understanding a hindrance, understanding like desire or anger fully, or restlessness and sloth and torpor fully, means usually that you have to overcome it. Because only when you have overcome it completely can you look back and know that it actually is no longer there. And then you understand what that blemish actually is. So before you overcome it, you cannot be sure there might be still a tiny little bit left. So even when your samadhi goes well, even if you have a lot of piti sukha, a lot of happiness in the mind, there might still be a very slight remainder left which blocks you from either from insight or from even deeper states of samadhi. So this is what it means to you. First and foremost, it means overcoming them through samadhi, in particular things like the jhanas. And then you know that you've overcome them, so then you know what those hindrances are. And next time you have a problem, you can actually relate back to that jhana state, and then you know that this is what you have now is not the pure mind anymore. So that is the first thing, what it means by understanding as it actually is. It means overcoming it completely, so that you have a reference point to what these defilements are. But the second thing, an even more profound thing it means stream entry. This is the usual meaning of yathabhuta, which is what actually is here means, and pajanati, understanding. It means stream entry. And one of the things that you overcome as a stream enter is doubt. And doubt in the suttas means doubt about what is wholesome and what is unwholesome, what is good, what is bad, what is dark, what is bright, what is worthwhile, what is not worthwhile. So that is essentially the meaning of doubt in the suttas. So once you have overcome doubt, once you have become a stream enter, it means that you have a direct knowledge and understanding of what good things, good qualities are, and what bad qualities are. So at that point, you can no longer be deluded about these things. So that is the second thing. And in both these cases, both of these things are probably meant here. They're just different levels of understanding here. Okay, so that is the understanding blemishes as they actually are. And of course, the self-view is the same thing. The self-view you can only understand as it actually is once you attain stream entry. Because that is when you, for the very first time, you penetrate that problem of self, of view of the self fully, and you know what it's all about. Okay, so then Venerable Sariputra goes on. He says, "Herein, the person with a blemish who does not understand it as it actually is thus, I have a blemish in myself, is called inferior, the inferior of these two persons with a blemish. Herein, the person with a blemish who understands as it actually is thus, I have a blemish in myself, is called superior of these two persons with a blemish." So understanding is always one of the things that in Buddhism is called like superior in a sense. Herein, the person with no blemish, who does not understand it as it actually is thus, I have no blemish, is called inferior of these two persons with no blemish. And herein, the person with no blemish, who understands that it actually is thus, I have no blemish, is called the superior of these two persons with no blemish. So it's interesting that in the suttas, when we actually see this idea of inferiority and superiority, is actually used quite a lot in the suttas. You have like the saparisa, the true person, or the true man, as it's sometimes translated, and the non-true person. And you have hina, and you have panita, which means like inferior and superior. And they always refer to, of course, to qualities of the heart, or qualities of the mind. They refer to things like virtue. They refer to things, particularly things like understanding or wisdom. These are the things which make somebody a superior person or inferior person. These are the only things which are worthy, according to suttas, to make this kind of distinction with. Yes?
Is the Pali word superior, is
Yeah.
So how do we distinguish? How do we understand?
The partly words ahina and panita, and they no setta is actually the word, eh? And then basically mean inferior and superior, pretty much what they mean there. So it is inferior and superior, but that doesn't mean that you judge. It just means that that is you know that is how it is considered according to Dhamma practice.
What about like you know the three conceits? Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's a distinction there between your subjective relationship to other people and the view of the Dhamma.
Right.
From a Dhamma point of view, one is inferior, one is superior. Yeah? But you don't have a you know subjective personal sense that you are superior or inferior to that person. Yeah? Yeah. Exactly, it's superior according. Yeah, it's superior in a very kind of a limited sense, in the sense that simply this is how we define superiority according to the Dhamma. It's not a personal or subjective thing at all. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So then. Venerable Mahamoggallana comes on the scene, and he, when this was said, the Venerable Mahamoggallana asked the Venerable Sariputta, "Friend Sariputta, what is the cause and reason why of these two persons with a blemish, one is called inferior and one is called superior? What is the cause and reason why of these two persons with no blemish, one is called inferior and one is called superior?" They have man here in the translation, and that is because the Pali has the word man, but of course it relates to men and women just equally, so there's no distinction there. It's just that the suttas tend to be spoken to bhikkhus, and that's why it tends to be a bit kind of male-oriented usually. So this is what Venerable Sariputta replies. "Herein, friend, when a person with a blemish does not understand it as it actually is thus, I have a blemish in myself, it can be expected that he will not arouse zeal, make effort, or instigate energy to abandon that blemish, that he will die with lust, hate, and delusion, with a blemish, with a mind defiled. Suppose a bronze dish were brought from a shop, or a smithy, covered with dirt and stains, and the owners neither used it nor had it cleaned, but put it away in a dusty corner. Would the bronze dish thus get more defiled and stained later on? Yes, friend. So too, friend, when a person with a blemish does not understand it as it actually is thus, I have a blemish in myself, it can be expected that he will die with a mind defiled." So this is the problem here. If you don't understand that something is a blemish, basically, you don't make any effort to do anything about it. And you know what it's like when you say to people in the world, you might say to somebody, all these desires are just causing troubles for you and all these kind of things. Normally, they will just shrug their shoulders and say, what do you mean it's a problem with desire? Desire is important. It makes the world go round. It makes the economy work. If you had many desires, it wouldn't work. And people identify with their desires, and it's an important aspect of their life. And I like that what Ajahn Brahm was saying in his last talk, when he was talking about craving, and he was basically saying that the very sense of craving very often gives people meaning. And it's not so much actually getting the object, which is important, it's actually the craving itself very often, which is like the thing that we identify with. Craving is an important aspect of us, and we feel that actually the drive to get the object sometimes is more important than the object is itself. It becomes very silly when the object is not important, because then what's the purpose of the driver? And yet the drive is even more important than the actual object sometimes. So that is a problem. If you think like that, if you think that craving is important and wonderful, and you identify it, and you think that this is me, etc., of course, you will have no desire, you have no zeal, you make no effort to overcome these defilements, because you don't see the purpose in these things. You don't understand that there is a problem there. So the very first thing you have to understand is that there actually is a problem. There is something which needs to be worked with. And then, when you understand that, that's when you put forth the zeal and effort. Otherwise, you don't. And this nice, very nice simile here about this bronze dish And if you have a bronze dish which is dirty and stained, just like the mind might be dirty and stained, and you neither use it nor clean it, and obviously this using and cleaning is here a simile for putting forth effort to purify your mind, but you put it away in a dusty corner, that I think is similar to if you don't pay any attention to your own mind, if you don't look inside of yourself, if you don't have clear awareness of what is going on, you don't look at yourself with clarity, that is like putting your mind away in a dusty corner, not really looking at it, not being clear as to what is happening. So this is similar to putting this bronze dish away in the dusty corner. And when you do that, what happens is that it accumulates even more dust, even more problems. That's what it says here. You will actually die with a mind defiled. And this is one of those interesting things in the Dhamma, is that unless you actually do practice to overcome defilements and problems, if you don't do anything at all, it tends to go the other way. You tend to get more defiled, more problems coming, more things happening in life. One of the nice suttas, which in a sense talk about this, which many of you probably have read, and which is like a mythological account in the sense of the defilements, etc., is the Aganya Sutta and the Digha Nikaya. And the Aganya Sutta and the Digha Nikaya talks about how the world essentially evolves, how people evolve from, or not people, but beings evolve from a very high plane. And after they have, after they pass away from this very high plane, then they go to a lower plane. And then when they look upon other beings, or they look upon the earth, and they see something nice, desire will arise in them. Then when desire arises, they start indulging in those things which look nice in the world. And when they start indulging, they become more coarse. When they become more coarse, they start doing things which are even more coarse. And gradually, see how desire and actually giving into those desires gradually coarsens the mind. And they get reborn in a more and more coarse destination until they become like ordinary human beings. But they started off in the Brahma realm. And I think that sutta, one way of reading the Aganya Sutta, is to read it as a simile or a mythology or a legend, which is roughly equivalent to the way the mind tends to develop in the world, unless you actually restrain it, unless you hold back and you understand the danger in these things. The general evolution tends to be towards more defilements. Nicholas.
Being done so the mind replenishes. Is the opportunity for the development of the awareness of whether there's blemishes or not, is that opportunity strongest when there's also a physical body, or can that awareness and practice continue when there is death?
I think you can have that awareness anywhere, really. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't really depend on the physical body. But I think that in certain realms, it's just very difficult. I mean, if you have a lot of suffering in your life, if you get reborn in the animal realm, it's very difficult to have enough clarity because you're just concerned with survival and suffering and problems. It's too difficult to have awareness. And that is why they tend to say in the sutta, if you get reborn in the lower realm, you can't really do very much. You just have to sort of abide your time and wait to get reborn in the human realm again. And I think for devas, it might be often, it's probably the other way around, that it's just enjoyable, you enjoy yourself, and you become heedless, and you forget about the purification. But I think as a deva, it is possible to continue practicing in some way, because you know that's why the Buddha was called teacher of gods and humans, because he taught the devas. And there are many cases in the suttas of the devas attaining arya stages, for example, becoming, you know, stream enterers and all those kind of things. So I think it is possible as devas, but in the lower realm, certainly, it seems to be impossible pretty much.
Because, I mean, to get that sort of awareness of blemish, from what I understood before, is that there has to be the experience of states which are free of blemishes to give up contrast and meaning to whether a blemish is there or not there.
Mm.
So, does that mean that it's easier to see the blemishes when the contrast is greater, or say in some other realms, you can't really experience a freedom from them to really see what they are?
I think the blemish is not just the freedom that you have to see, but you can see the relative presence, right? Some days the blemishes are worse than other days. And that's really enough to start giving you a sense of the full understanding, the full yathabhuta jnanadasana, the full seeing of what a blemish actually is. It only happens when it disappears completely. But you already have some idea because you can see the up and down of the mind. It goes up and down. Sometimes you're really upset, other times you're quite peaceful. You know, things go up and down. And that will always be the same in all realms. You know, there are always going to be the ups and downs of these things. I think it's always possible to see it. It's just whether you have the enough capacity left rather than just dealing with the suffering to be able to see. I think that is maybe the issue there.
If there's too much happiness, there's a lot of happiness.
Yeah.
Is that also a difficulty to see in the blemish?
I guess that depends on... I mean, the problem with sensual indulgence is that it distracts you. So you tend to, you know, indulge instead because it's very attractive. You tend to go that way. That might make it more difficult. But it's not impossible because it's still there. You know, the mind is still going to sort of go up and down and change this way and that way.
Perhaps it's more subtle.
You happy? Yeah? Yes. Okay. So, once you understand that there is a blemish, then if you don't understand it, there's no chance of doing anything with it. And that's why it says here, you die with a greed, hatred, and delusion, or lust, hate, and delusion, with a mind defiled, because you never did anything to overcome those things. And then there is the second type of person, and Venerable Sariputta says the following here. Herein, when a person with a blemish understands it as it actually is thus, I have a blemish in myself, it can be expected that he will arouse zeal, make effort, and instigate energy to abandon that blemish. That he will die without lust, hate, and delusion, without blemish, with mind undefiled. Suppose a bronze dish was brought from a shop or a smithy, covered with dirt and stains, and the owners used it and had it cleaned and did not put it in a dusty corner. Would the bronze dish thus get cleaner and brighter later on? Yes, friend. So true, friend, when a person with a blemish understands it as it actually is thus, I have a blemish in myself, it can be expected that he will die with mind undefiled. So here it is the case that you actually understand that there is a problem. And only when you understand that there is a problem, do you actually start doing something with that problem. And that's why, you know, the Four Noble Truths always start off with the idea of dukkha, first of all. You understand suffering. And this here is really just understanding one aspect of that suffering. You understand suffering, only when you understand that there is a problem, can you do something about it. That's just like everything else in the world. And because of that, when you do that, that is how it can be expected, it says here, that you die without lust, hate, and delusion. Or if it doesn't mean that, at the very least, it means that you will be progressing in the right direction towards abandonment of lust, hate, and delusion. So it obviously doesn't mean, just because you understand there's a blemish, doesn't necessarily mean that you will become an arahant in this life. But at least you will be moving in the right direction.
And why is it that someone with no blemish, but he doesn't understand it, why is it that he can be expected to die with the mind defiled if he doesn't have a blemish?
Well, the point is that, and this comes up next in the next one here, comes up later on. The point is that the blemish is starting to rise again here. This is a problem here. So that is why what we are talking about here is very likely to be a reference to samadhi practice. Somebody who, you know, has had some good samadhi, or they get reborn from a very lofty realm here, and then they come back to the human realm here. And because they don't really understand that I have a pure mind as it is, they don't protect that mind, they're not careful with it. And because they don't protect it, not careful with it, blemishes start to rise again. And that is a problem here. So that is why I think this is about samadhi in particular. And this is what I mean, that these suttas are layered, they have many layers of meaning. They can refer to samadhi or insight or other things as well. It's anga, angana. Angana, yeah. I mean, like spot, dirt, blemish. Yeah. That's why it's called the Anangana Sutta. Yeah. Okay, so then we go on, and this is the next section here. And Venerable Sariputta says, Herein, when a person with no blemish does not understand it as it actually is thus, I have no blemish in myself, it can be expected that he will give attention to the sign of the beautiful, Deioarchus, that by this doing so, lust will infect his mind, that he will die with lust, hate, and illusion, with a blemish, with mind defiled. Suppose a bronze dish were brought from a shop or smithy, clean and bright, and the owners neither used it nor had it cleaned, but put it in a dusty corner. When the bronze dish thus got more defiled and more stained later on, yes, friend, so too, friend, when a person with no blemish does not understand it as it actually is thus, I have no blemish in myself, it can be expected that he will die with a mind defiled. So this person here is somebody who doesn't have a blemish. Obviously, this is not a reference to inside, it's not a reference to the Arya states, because somebody who is an Arya, by definition, would have that understanding what blemishes are. So this here must refer to somebody with samadhi, somebody maybe been reborn from the Brahma realm, or somebody who had some samadhi before her. And then they don't really understand that, well, actually, I've gotten rid of these blemishes, and now I need to be careful. And because of that, they start attending to the world in the wrong way. And this is what is meaning of this giving attention to the sign of the beautiful. It means that you look at things in the wrong kind of way. Sign here, this word is nimitta, and it can mean like object, it can mean appearance, it can mean aspect of something. So you're looking for the beautiful aspect in things. It's like the human body. You can look at the human body in many different ways. You can look for the beautiful aspect in the human body, or you can look for the aspect which is not beautiful. And of course, this is one of the very important meditations in Buddhism. That's why we do this kind of meditation. And you find that in the Satipatthana Sutta. It's the recollection of the actual composition of the body. It's called the 30 constituent parts of the body. And sometimes that is called like a repulsive meditation, but it's not so much repulsive as asubha is like the negation of beautiful. So it means non-beautiful. It's like the A is like, it doesn't actually make it a negative term, it just deprives it of the positive value. So it means like a non-beautiful meditation, seeing things as they actually are, to help you to get away from some of the problems that arise if you always see the beautiful in things. And that, very interestingly, if you read the Satipatthana Sutta, how you're supposed to contemplate the body, the 31 aspects of the body, always it's your own body that you should look at, not the body of others. Once you overcome the sense of attachment or infatuation with your own body, that is when automatically infatuation with other people's bodies also will disappear at the same time. It's always your own body that you should look at, first of all. So just remember, and it's actually quite obvious when you think about it. As they say, beauty is only skin deep. And it's very, very obvious that a body without skin is not a very beautiful thing. And so there's only this very thin layer which sort of hides the reality, which is always there, of this human body.
So, I think many times, I guess, with the asubha, then, you know, we tend to go to the negative side instead of being on the, like you said, it takes the value away.
Yeah.
So we're not, you know, it is kind of negative side instead of staying in that kind of zero.
Right, yeah.
You know, that's an interest in me because it doesn't have any interest.
Yeah. And, but but if you think about it, like, you know, a heart or a kidney or whatever, even a skeleton as such, it's just something which does its function. It's not really, I mean, it can be maybe repulsive, and some parts of the body might even be repulsive. But generally speaking, it's just something which does its function. It's not really either repulsive or non-repulsive.
Yeah.
It's just a neutral thing, yeah. But it's not something you're attracted to. It's like a skeleton. You're not really attracted to a skeleton. It's not something which is, you know, beautiful either. So it kind of neutralizes you. And when you think about your own body, you know, 95% of this is just all this internal stuff. The skin is hardly anything at all.
Because, you know, a lot of the super stuff is really like...
Yeah, and exactly. And I don't know. I think... I mean, I always remember the Parajika 3 story, the origin story to Parajika 3. It basically says that, you know, the story there with all the monks committing suicide and that sort of thing because they were doing too much of super practice. And I think the point is that you... you have to find that balance. You know, you don't want to make your life too miserable, but at the same time, you want to make sure that you don't kind of stray away from the. So find that balance in life is important, I think. And it's always good to combine with metta. You know, metta and sila together is always a good thing. Yeah. So this is the sign of the beautiful. It's basically the aspect of the beautiful. So any object, the point here is that any object can be looked at from different sides, whether it's a human body or whether it's food or whether it's anything else. There's always two sides to it. There's a beautiful side, and then there is the side which is not beautiful. And it's how you attend to the thing, which then is the important thing. How, not what you look at, but how you attend to things is even more important than what you look at. And that is so that is kind of the underlying thing here. Yes?
So here I'm just saying, it seems it's quite functional. Basically, we look in a way so as not to have any sensory lust over food. But I'm just remembering, like, when Rams talked about perception of beautiful, he encouraged us to train our mind to look at ways to give wholesome state of mind, like gratitude.
Yeah.
So do you think like a good practice for this is, well, let's say if you look at food, one perception of beautiful is looking at the physical things that give rise to lust for the food. We would also look at another perception of beautiful that gives rise to gratitude.
Yeah.
So there's like two different types of
perceptions. Sure. Yeah. It's true.
Is that a good way of practicing this one? Like, we can't have lust, but if you have a perception of beautiful,
like,
ascribed to gratitude.
Yeah, no, of course it is. But this is not really, I think, Subha in the sutta is usually referred to like the direct experience of something that you get through the senses. But what you're talking about is more like a conceptual thing. You know, you're thinking about the, you know, the people who put effort into the food, and you think gratitude for that. You know, and so the concept that you have, and that is not really Subha as such, but it's just a beautiful way of looking at it. Of course, you had to make that distinction. Sure. Yeah. Okay.
It's like perceiving the beauty though in like things which you can use it to stillness. Isn't that sort of part of the the skillful means, like seeing the beauty in the present moments and things like this. This kind of warning of perceiving the beauty is that's more to do with things that support outflow.
Well, this is basically about Subha here, is the things that give rise to sensual desire. That's what it is. So whatever you looked at, which gives rise to sensual desire, that is what is here is called Subha. And Asubha is that which counteracts the arising of sensual desire. So any contemplation which does not give rise to sensual desire, but which gives rise to any kind of other, you know, wholesome state, whether it's peace or metta or compassion or whatever, of course, it's good. That's the right kind of positive state. Yeah.
So it seems like beauty has to be used in a wise way.
Yeah, exactly. Precisely. Yeah. Everything. I mean, you can sort of divide everything into kind of the wise way and the bad way. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Okay. So, and this is also this idea of giving attention to the sign of the beautiful is what you find with the first hindrance. This is the way that the first hindrance always arises when you give the wrong attention to the sign of the beautiful. That's how it works. So if you want to avoid that, then you have to avoid giving attention to the sign of the beautiful, essentially. And when you do that, then of course lust infects the mind. Lust here is very broad thing. It means like any sensual desire basically infects the mind. And then even though previously you had no blemishes, now you have blemishes because you're using your mind in an unskillful way, because you don't really understand how blemishes work, what blemishes are, how they arise. And this is, if you remember your Satipatthana Sutta well, you remember that in the Dhamma Nupassana, the recollection of the Dhammas, or the contemplation of the Dhammas, the last section of the Satipatthana Sutta, there's two sections there. One is the contemplation of the hindrances, and the other one is the contemplation of the seven bhujangas, the enlightenment factors. These are the two main aspects of the Satipatthana Sutta. And the understanding that you're supposed to have according to the Satipatthana Sutta is you're supposed to know if a hindrance is there. You're supposed to know if it is absent. You're supposed to know what makes it arise, and you're supposed to know how we can get rid of it if it arises. So this is what it means to understand these hindrances as they actually are. So you basically understand the whole dynamic around these hindrances. So that is why that particular aspect of the Satipatthana Sutta is quite important and quite prominent, and it relates directly to what you're seeing here in Yathabhuta, a full understanding or correct understanding of the blemishes and the hindrances. So that is the problem. By not understanding, it gives rise to these same defilements again. But on the other hand, Venerable Sariputta goes on, when a person with no blemish understands it as it actually is thus, I have no blemish in myself, it can be expected that he will not give attention to the sign of the beautiful, that by his not doing so, lust will not infect his mind, and that he will die without lust, hate, and delusion, without blemish, with mind undefiled. Suppose a bronze dish were brought from a shop or a smithy, clean and bright, and the owners used it and had it cleaned, and did not put it in a dusty corner. Would that bronze dish thus get cleaner and brighter later on? Yes, friend. So too, friend, when a person with no blemish understands as it actually is thus, I have no blemish in myself, it can be expected that he will die with mind undefiled. So you can see the point here is that if you do understand that your mind is without blemishes, then you will continue practicing in the right way until, as it says here, that this becomes even more bright, even more clean, because you're purifying it even more, because you have an understanding of what's going on. And because of that, instead of then losing your samadhi, you will keep your samadhi, and you will take it further also to get insight as well. And that is why you can expect greed, hate, and delusion to pass away completely, as it says here. Greed, hate, and delusion, you can die without greed, hate, and delusion. So both aspects come together here. So those are the four types of person. And having set up the outline here, then he goes on to describe what these blemishes actually are. That's the next part of the sutta. So, just 1 second. Okay, so Venerable Sariputta goes on. This is the cause and reason why of these two persons with a blemish, one is called the inferior person and one is called the superior one. This is the cause and reason why of these two persons with no blemish, one is called inferior and one superior. Blemish is said, friend, but what is this word blemish a term for? Blemish, friend, is a term for the spheres of evil, unwholesome desires or wishes. I don't particularly like the word evil. It has very kind of Christian ideas to it. I think maybe bad or unskillful is better. So is a term for the sphere of bad, unwholesome desires. I would prefer to translate that rather than using the word evil. In fact, bad is the new translation for this word. It's papa is the Pali word for what is translated as evil here. And then he goes on. It is possible that the bhikkhu here might wish, if I commit an offense, let the bhikkhus not know that I have committed an offense. And it is possible that the bhikkhus come to know that bhikkhu has committed an offense. So he is angry and displeased. Thus, the bhikkhus know I have committed an offense. The anger and displeasure are both a blemish. I prefer displeasure rather than bitterness myself. Bitterness sounds to me a little bit different. So here is a monk who obviously he may commit some offense, presumably against the Vinaya, or if not against the Vinaya, maybe just he does something which is bad, regardless of whether it's in the Vinaya or not. I think that is an important point, which I always like to make, is that the vinaya doesn't always cover everything which is immoral here. Morality can extend beyond the vinaya. And it's not enough just to follow the vinaya. Often you have to actually make sure you practice morality in an even deeper way than that. And it always reminds me of one sutta which I, actually it's in the vinaya. And there is a monk who is listening to the Buddha while the Buddha is giving a discourse. And while the Buddha is giving a discourse, he has this fault-finding mind. He says, oh, this Buddha, he's asking too much. I don't want to follow all these rules and regulations. And he gets very negative and upset with the Buddha. And then later on, he realized that was a mistake. And he goes after the Buddha a long distance to find the Buddha again and apologizes for having this thought, which was negative and fault-finding. Yeah. Quite remarkable. Obviously, there's no rule in the vinaya against thinking bad thoughts. And yet he realized that thinking the bad thought was inappropriate and wrong. So he goes to actually apologize to the Buddha for this bad thought. And he says, there, yeah, I've committed an offense. Same word as here. An offense is what he's committed. And that is what he then apologizes for afterwards. So this could mean both. It could mean either just an offense of that kind, which is your personal mistake, or it can mean an offense against the vinaya itself. And of course, if you don't want the other monks to know about your offense, it's basically a very bad thing. It's like hiding hiding from others what you have done. And that's a very negative thing. It's going to block your chance of getting anywhere on the Buddhist path if you do that sort of thing. Yeah? And it's one of the qualities of a stream enter, of a sotapanna, that he or she is incapable of ever hiding an offense. They will always be open about the offenses straight away. This is one of the qualities. And that goes back to, again, what I was mentioning before, about understanding the distinction between wholesome and the unwholesome. They know that very well. And because they know it so clearly, they would never hide an offense if they do something wrong. So that is the first thing here. And you can see here straight away that what we are dealing with here is somebody who is proud and has wrong ideas. It's all about self-view that we're coming to here. Pride and the sense of self which is coming into this. And then, of course, once you have that self-view, then anger and displeasure arises when that kind of self-view gets thwarted by circumstances and you don't have that same good perception of yourself anymore. That is the first one here. We'll move on. It is possible that a bhikkhu here might wish, I have committed an offense. The bhikkhus should admonish me in private, not in the middle of the sangha. And it is possible that the bhikkhus admonish that bhikkhu in the middle of the sangha, not in private. So he is angry and displeased. Thus, the bhikkhus admonish me in the middle of the sangha, not in private. The anger and displeasure are both a blemish. So again, you can see you don't want it to be known that you have a blemish. You want sort of your status to be greater than it actually deserves to be. And again, this obviously has to do with pride. It has to do with basically a negative, a kind of wrong idea of what the, of how to of ego, essentially. That's what it's about here. It is possible that the bhikkhu he might wish, I have committed an offense. A person who is my equal should admonish me, not the person who is not my equal. And it is possible that the person who is not his equal admonishes him, not the person who is his equal. So he is angry and displeased. A person not my equal admonishes me, not a person my equal. The anger and displeasure are both a blemish. And here the person who is an equal, it's not entirely clear what that means, but presumably it can be have a quite wide meaning. It can mean somebody maybe who is a senior or junior to you, or maybe somebody who is has a higher ranking than you, or somebody who maybe is more advanced on the path. But usually people like to be admonished maybe by one of their mates or somebody who does the same kind of stupid things, and it doesn't feel so bad. But if somebody who is purer than you admonishes you, might often feel bad, and again it might have an effect on your ego. So again, it's an ego thing. It's about pride and about conceit perhaps. Yes.
But here, I'm a bit confused now. So what is the Buddha? Does the Buddha want his monks to get admonishment from other monks? Like, could you explain what admonishment is and how that is part of training and a part of the training that you get out?
Yeah. Well, it's just... I'm not sure exactly what the Pali word is here, but I'll just look it up because I've got the Pali here. You should confess your offenses. If you make a mistake according to the Vinaya, you should confess your offenses.
But the admonishment part.
Well, the idea here is it depends on what kind of person you are. But if you are somebody, here it seems to be talking about somebody who is hiding their offense, right? And if you are actually hiding your offense and somebody sees that you are doing that, you have an obligation to tell them that, you know, you shouldn't be doing this, you should confess your offenses. That is one of the things. Otherwise, the whole sangha starts to collapse if people start to do all kind of crazy things. It doesn't function anymore. If somebody, you know, doesn't follow the Vinaya, that's your obligation. That's probably part of what's happening here.
But in the Pachimokkha, the monks, they confess, but is there
No.
What's the context?
It's not, the way it works in the Pachimokkha is that you confess your offense if you have one. And then the other person says, do you see your offense? And you reply, yes, I see my offense. And then he says, you should restrain yourself in the future. And he says, yes, I undertake restraint for the future. That's all that's happening. It's not admonishment apart from that. So it's just, you know, you're just basically accepting that you did an offense and that you are going to try to improve yourself in the future.
So do they need somebody else?
Admonishment more happens, as I said, if you don't want to see your offenses and you do things without confessing it, and then other people see you doing that, then that's when you have a problem. And that's when you might bring the person into the sangha, and you might say, well, you know, what's happening here? You know, you shouldn't, you know, are you doing these things? And they might, you know, that's when admonishment happens. Yeah. Okay, so then the Venerable Sariputta goes on. It is possible that the bhikkhu here might wish, oh, that the teacher might teach the Dhamma to the bhikkhus by asking a series of questions of me, not of some other bhikkhu. And it is possible that the teacher teaches the Dhamma to the bhikkhus by asking a series of questions of some other bhikkhu, not of that bhikkhu. So he is angry and displeased thus. The teacher teaches the Dhamma to the bhikkhus by asking a series of questions of some other bhikkhu, not of me. And the anger and displeasure are both a blemish. Again, it's about pride. You want to be almost like the teacher's pet here. So you know, this is obviously very, very silly. It is possible that the bhikkhu here might wish, oh, that the bhikkhus might enter the village for alms, putting me in the forefront, not some other bhikkhu. And it is possible that the bhikkhus enter the village for alms, putting some other bhikkhu in the forefront, not that bhikkhu. So he is angry and displeased thus. The bhikkhus enter the village for alms, putting some other bhikkhu in the forefront, not me. And the anger and displeasure are both a blemish. So this obviously is about status. You want to be famous. You want to be the one to greet the lay people in alms round or whatever. It is possible that the bhikkhu here might wish, oh, that I might get the best seat, the best water, the best alms foods in the refectory, and not some other bhikkhu. And it is possible that some other bhikkhu might get all these things, and not he. So again, he gets angry and displeased. It is possible that the bhikkhu here might wish, or that I might give the blessing, it says here. This is more like the teaching after the meal. This is the anumodana. In those days, they didn't give blessings, they gave teachings after the meal, like a short teaching on the power of generosity or any other teaching. And it has sort of degenerated over the centuries to become like this automatic blessing, chanting that we do. But in the old days, they actually gave a proper teaching. But it is possible that some other bhikkhu will give that teaching after the meal, and then he gets angry and displeased because of that. It is possible that a bhikkhu here might wish, oh, that I might teach the Dhamma to the bhikkhus, to the bhikkhunis, to the male lay followers, to the women lay followers visit in the monastery, not some other bhikkhu. And it is possible that some other bhikkhu teaches the Dhamma to all of these. Again, you can see about fame, about gain, about honor, about respect. This is what this monk is after. This kind of thinking really boils down to. It is possible that the bhikkhu here might wish, oh, that the bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, men lay followers, women lay followers, might honor, respect, revere, and venerate me, not some other bhikkhu. And it is possible that they honor and respect and venerate some other bhikkhu and not him. In fact, you will see later on, all of these qualities are qualities that lead to you not being respected. So if you want to be respected, you better put these qualities aside. It is possible that a bhikkhu here might wish, oh, that I might be the one to get a superior robe, superior alms food, superior resting place, just like a kuti, superior medicinal requisite, not some other bhikkhu. And it is possible that some other bhikkhu is the one to get all these superior things. And because of that, he is angry and displeased. And that anger and displeasure, they are both a blemish. So this is all about blemishes. So these are the blemishes here. And essentially, what we are talking about here, we are of course talking about anger and displeasure, which is one of the five hindrances. But we're also talking about here, this is not about ego, about esteem, about... you will see that these things classify very neatly under the three things known as labha, sakara, siloka in the suttas. Labha is gain. We're talking about getting the four requisites here. Sakara is like honor. So a lot of this is about honor, about position, about status. And siloka is fame, again about being the one who is at the center of attention. This is what all of this classifies as. And it's interesting that this Venerable Sariputta here basically gives a whole teaching on the danger of labha, sakara, siloka, on these three things. That's essentially what he's doing here, showing how dangerous it is and how it leads astray. And to give you some idea of what the Buddha said about these things, I will read a couple of short suttas from the Sanyutta Nikaya about labha, sakara, siloka, and how dangerous these things actually are. And not only how dangerous they are, but also how little happiness there is to be gained from these things. So this is one, and you might want to read this, there's a whole Sanyutta, a whole chapter called the Labha Sakara Sanyutta, which is about these kind of things and about the dangers in these things. So this sutta is called the Hook, and this is happens at Savati. Bhikkhus, dreadful are gain, honor and praise, bitter, vile, obstructive to achieving the unsurpassed security from bondage. The unsurpassed security from bondage is arahantship, full enlightenment. Suppose a fisherman would cast the baited hook into a deep lake, and a fish on the lookout for food would swallow it. That fish, having swallowed the fisherman's hook, would meet with calamity and disaster, and the fisherman could do with it as he wishes. Fisherman bhikkhus, this is a designation for Mara, the evil one. Baited hook, this is a designation for gain, honor, and praise. Any bhikkhu who relishes and enjoys the arisen gain, honor, and praise is called a bhikkhu who has swallowed the baited hook, who has met with calamity and disaster, and the evil one can do with him as he wishes. So dreadful, bhikkhus, are gain, honor, and praise, so bitter, vile, obstructive to achieving the unsurpassed security from bondage. Therefore, bhikkhus, you should train yourselves thus. We will abandon the arisen gain, honor, and praise, and we will not let the arisen gain, honor, and praise persist obsessing our minds. Thus, you should train yourself. And this is a thing which goes on and on throughout this chapter, about the danger of these things. And of course, Devadatta is the prime example in the suttas about somebody who became obsessed with these things because he was even the king. Adatasattu was his disciple, and of course it's very easy to get a bit conceited when the king becomes your disciple. You think that you are something special, and that's what can happen. And here is another sutta about gain, honor and praise, and this shows you, this sutta shows you how little happiness there actually is in this compared to the happiness of the path. Again, it's Atsavati, because dreadful are gain, honor and praise, just like before. And then there's a simile. Suppose there was a beetle, a dung eater, stuffed with dung, full of dung, and in front of her was a large dunghill. Because of this, she would despise the other beetles, thinking, I am a dung eater, stuffed with dung, full of dung, and in front of me there is a large dunghill. So too bhikkhus, a bhikkhu here, whose mind is overcome and obsessed by gain, honor and praise, dresses in the morning, and taking bowl and robe, enters a village or town for alms. There he would eat as much as he wants, he would be invited for the next day's meal, and his alms food would be plentiful. When he goes back to the monastery, he boasts before the group of bhikkhus, I have eaten as much as I want, I have been invited for tomorrow's meal, and my alms food is plentiful. I am one who gains robes, alms food, lodgings, and medicinal requisites. But these other bhikkhus have little merit and influence. They do not gain robes, alms food, lodgings, and medicinal requisites. Thus, because his mind is overcome and obsessed by gain, honor, and praise, he despises the other well-behaved bhikkhus. That will lead to his harm and suffering of this senseless person for a long time. So dreadful bhikkhus are gain, honor and praise, etc. So basically they are like eating dung. So obviously the Buddha is making the point that there is something much more important to be attained on this path than just requisites, or indeed honor, or indeed praise, or indeed fame. But these things are very low in comparison to these other things. Anyway, that is about gain, honor and praise. Labha Sakara Siloka. Okay, so then we come back to the sutta again. Now we have seen that, as it says here, blemish friend is a term for the spheres of these evil and wholesome wishes. And then Venerable Sariputta goes on. If the spheres of these evil and wholesome wishes are seen and heard to be unabandoned in any bhikkhu, then, for all he may be a forest dweller, a frequenter of remote abodes, an alms food eater, a house-to-house seeker, a refuse rag wearer, a wearer of rough robes, still his fellows in the holy life do not honor, respect, revere, and venerate him. Why is that? Because the sphere of these evil, unwholesome wishes are seen and heard to be unabandoned in that venerable one. So here you can see somebody who practices many of the ascetic practices. These are the practices you find elsewhere in the suttas. You're an alms food eater, in other words, you don't go to invitations, that sort of thing. A house-to-house eater means somebody who goes to every house without interruption, not somebody who chooses the houses they go to. A refuse rag wearer, this is the Pangsukula Chivara, the Chivara which comes from the dust heap. Pangsukula literally means dust heap. So it's like just a cloth you find on the ground somewhere, maybe on the charnel ground, and you sew it all together into a robe. It's one of the ascetic practices. And a wearer of rough robes, these are like maybe robes that are not comfortable to wear. But this is not the point of the holy life, to wear these kind of things, to do ascetic practices. The point of the holy life is to actually abandon all these evil wishes and abandon the hindrances. And if you still have all these negative things in your mind, and perhaps you do ascetic practices just to look good, then of course the whole thing is pointless. That is not what it's all about. If you do ascetic practices, it should be to abandon these things, not to sort of somehow perhaps even hide them under the surface. So that is the problem here. So then you have the simile coming up next. Suppose a bronze dish were brought from a shop or a smithy, clean and bright, and the owners put the carcass of a snake or a dog or a human being in it, and, covering it with another dish, went back to the market. Then people seeing it said, "What is that you are carrying about like a treasure?" Then raising the lid and uncovering it, they looked in, and as soon as they saw, they were inspired with such loathing, repugnance, and disgust, that even those who were hungry would not want to eat, not to speak of those who were full. So this is, you can see here the point here, that you look like a bhikkhu on the outside, you might even do ascetic practices, but on the inside there's something which is repulsive, and that is why you don't get that respect, honor, and fame that you're actually craving for. This person is obviously craving for that, they have the wish, may I be respected, all these things. But in fact, they get the opposite because of their practice. So too, if the spheres of these evil, unwholesome wishes are seen and heard to be unabandoned in any bhikkhu, then for all that he may be a forest dweller, etc., he is still not venerated, respected, as it said before. Then, so that is the case of somebody who has not abandoned these things. And then we have the opposite case. If the sphere of these evil, or rather bad, unwholesome wishes are seen and heard to be abandoned in any bhikkhu, or bhikkhuni for that matter, then for all he may be a village dweller, an acceptor of invitations, a wearer of robes given to him by householders, yet his fellows in the holy life honor, respect, revere, and venerate him. Why is that? Because the spheres of these evil, unwholesome wishes are seen and heard to be abandoned in that venerable. So the point is, of course, that this is what the holy life is about. So if you abandon those things, that is when you become venerated. It doesn't matter so much exactly how you live and what kind of robes, etc., you wear. Suppose a bronze dish were brought from a shop or a smithy, clean and bright, and the owners put clean boiled rice and various soups and sauces into it, and, covering it with another dish, went back to the market. Then people seeing it said, "What is that you are carrying about like a treasure?" Then raising the lid and uncovering it, they looked in, and as soon as they saw, they were inspired by such liking, appetite, and relish, that even those who were full would want to eat, not to speak of those who were hungry. In other words, when you see something worthy of praise, when you see somebody who practices the right way, you get inspired by that practice. And the externals are really irrelevant. It's the internals that really matters. In other words, the mind state is the internals. So too, friend, if the spheres of these evil and unwholesome wishes are seen and heard to be unabandoned in any bhikkhu, then for all he may be a village dweller, etc., etc., he still gets respected, revered, by his fellow monastics, because these unwholesome wishes have been abandoned in that venerable one. So that is what matters. So that is the main part of the sutta. Now comes the conclusion. Then we'll come to the last part here. When this was said, the Venerable Mahamoggallana said to the Venerable Sariputta, "The simile occurs to me, friend Sariputta," stated friend Moggallana, "on one occasion, friend, I was living in the hill fort at Rajagaha. Then, when it was morning, I dressed, and taking my bowl and outer robe, I went into Rajagaha for alms. Now on that occasion, Samiti, the cartwright's son, or the cartwright, was planing a fellow, and the Ajivaka Panduputta, son of a former cartwright, was standing by. Then this thought arose in the Ajivaka Panduputta's mind, 'Oh, that this Samiti, the cartwright's son, might plane this bend, this twist, this fault, out of the fellow, so that it would be without bends, twists, and faults, and come to consist purely of heartwood.' And just as this thought came to pass in his mind, So did Samiti, the Cartwright's son, claim that bend, that twist, that fault, out of the fellow. Then the Ajivika Panduputa, son of a former Cartwright, was glad, and he voiced his gladness thus. He plains just as if he knew my heart with his heart. So too, friend, there are persons who are faithless, have gone forth from the home life into homelessness, not out of faith, but seeking a livelihood, who are fraudulent, deceitful, treacherous, haughty, hollow, personally vain, rough-tongued, loose-spoken, unguarded in the sense faculties, immoderate in eating, undevoted to wakefulness, unconcerned with recluseship, not greatly respectful of training, luxurious, careless, leaders in backsliding, neglectful of seclusion, lazy, wanting in energy, unmindful, not fully aware, unconcentrated, with straying minds, devoid of wisdom, drivelers. The Venerable Sariputta, with his discourse on the Dhamma, plains out their faults, just as if he knew my heart with his heart. So this is a whole list here of what is obviously considered really dodgy monastics, dodgy monks. This is the kind of the worst case scenario of monks here, really. Yeah. So this is a sort of a person who is not really worthy of any respect, obviously. Yeah. And he says he plains out their faults. In other words, he points out their faults of these people. Yeah. Very often, if a person has as many faults as this, very often they don't care if you point out their faults, because they're not in it. They're not in the Dhamma to actually get rid of their faults. They're in the Dhamma for all kind of other reasons. As it says here, they have gone out of home life into homelessness, not out of faith, but seeking a livelihood. If you're seeking a livelihood, you're not really interested in learning about how to overcome your defilements, because that's not the point of your going forth. The point of your going forth is filling your stomach and getting a robe or whatever. That's when it becomes problematic. I think these days, most people can probably live much better in lay life than they can in monastic life. So very few people would actually choose to go forth just for livelihood. It doesn't seem to make much sense. So that is probably a good thing, because it means that most monks will be probably more serious about their practice. So these are the really dodgy ones, and that comes the opposite. But there are clansmen who have gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, who are not fraudulent, deceitful, treacherous, haughty, hollow, personally vain, rough-tongued, loose-spoken, who are guarded in their sense faculties, moderate in eating, devoted to wakefulness, concerned with recluseship, greatly respectful of training, not luxurious or careless, who are keen to avoid backsliding, leaders in seclusion, energetic, resolute, established in mindfulness, fully aware, concentrated, with unified minds, possessing wisdom, and not drivelers. These, on hearing the Venerable Sariputta's discourse on the Dhamma, drink it in, eat it as it were, by word and thought. Good indeed it is that he makes his fellows in the holy life emerge from the unwholesome and establishes themselves in the wholesome. So you can see here how it is the people who are already virtuous that will delight in this kind of discourse, who will enjoy this kind of discourse. Because if you have no virtue and you're not interested in virtue, you're going to find this a pain in the neck to hear about these sort of things. It is only if you have an interest in these things that you find these things inspiring. And of course, the vast majority of people, we're talking in particular about monastics here, would be somewhere in between these two types of bhikkhus. They might be quite as bad as the bad ones, and fewer will be quite as wise and as lofty as the good ones here. But the point is, and that is the point here really is, that whoever is serious about the practice, these are the people who will gain from this kind of discourse. So if you have an interest in the practice, and you haven't gone forth to fill your tummy or whatever, then this kind of thing is a very useful reminder for some of the defilements that may obstruct you in the practice. So you can know from your personal feeling when you read this. If you read this and you feel, yeah, this is great, this is interesting, then you know that you're on the right track. But if you feel, I hate this sort of stuff, I don't want to hear about this, then you know that's probably something is wrong with your practice. That is a good judge. The judge is not how many defilements you have. The judge is how you react to the discourse. Does somebody want to say something? Yeah, Richard.
This is a very general question. Did you speak the word punishment? What does that mean in relation to the social structure?
The Pali word is kulaputa. It means literally a son of the family. So the idea is that a family is like a good family, basically. Somebody who had a proper standing in Indian society, somebody who had a good income, who had a good livelihood, who had everything, basically. And when somebody like that goes forth, it's considered a good thing, because it's somebody who had prospects in the world. They didn't just go forth just because they didn't have anything better to do. They went forth even though they had prospects. That is why this is the kind of ideal person to go forth into monastic life. That's not the point. Anybody can join the Sangha. And there will be people who are serious from all walks of life who join the Sangha. But the point is more that if the teaching really is good, if it really is profound, it will attract people from everywhere. Even if you're wealthy, you will be attracted. Even if you're high status, you will be attracted. It will attract from across the board. And if it only attracts people who want to come in to get a livelihood, it's usually a bad sign. But if it attracts people for the right reasons, that's a good sign. So usually it will impress people. If they see a poor person entering, they will think, oh, I don't really know why he's entering. But if they see like the son of a king or something entering, or a daughter of a king, they will think, wow, there must be something powerful here. Otherwise, they wouldn't bother going for it. So it just makes more of an impact. Yes, Tom.
Just a sort of general question came up here. Why was it changed that the blessing is before the meal now, and the time of work was after the meal?
I think it's just practicalities, In those days, they might go to a family house, and they would be there for the meal, and then people would still be around. But here, it's like the way we work things here, everybody's there before the meal, so we give the blessing when everybody's there. But it's very strange. I find one of the things I find really, one of the problems with Buddhism is it's such an old religion, been around for 2,500 years, and things tend to become very ossified and kind of they have lost so much of their original purpose. And one of the things that have lost its original purpose is this blessing idea. In those days, it was a teaching. The Buddha would tell the people, good on you for giving something. This is going to lead to your happiness and well-being in the future. This is the right thing to do. And now what we do, it becomes like an entertainment where, the monks chant something. People like that, and it's fine. It's not necessarily wrong as such, but it has lost kind of much of its original meaning. And if you look across the Buddha's teachings, a lot of things that we do in Buddhism today has become like ossify and become like something you do without actually having any meaning. Its original meaning is lost. Classical example is the recitation of the Patimokkha for the monks. It used to be in those days, it was like a Vinaya teaching. You would tell everybody who was sitting around, listen to the Patimokkha rules, and you would listen and think, and it would remind you what you're supposed to do. It had a purpose. These days, the Patimokkha recitation is done in Pali. Very few monks understand Pali. It becomes like another of these rituals that you go through, that really having lost its original purpose. And this is one of the things, you see that throughout Buddhism, and it's not so bad in the Buddhism we have here, because we sort of try to reduce the rituals. But even here, you see a lot of the things that we do, in my opinion, you have lost some of the beautiful original meaning, and have become more ritualized instead. I'm not saying ritual is bad. I'm just saying that things have changed over the centuries. Yeah. Yes, Richard.
Is there something stopping, other than tradition, the Sangha from reciting things in a language that is understood?
Not really. I think we should do it. I've been pushing it around, saying let's do it in English. I think it's great, but it is difficult when you belong to a tradition, because the tradition will say you shouldn't do that. Ajahn Brahm has always been very kind of reluctant to go that way, because it's very easy to get blamed when you start changing things. You get blamed. People say you can't do that; it's wrong. And that is a problem very often. But of course, now in a sense, after the Bhikkhuni ordination, we are in so many ways more independent than we used to be before. So I think now might be the time to, if you want to do that sort of thing, we can probably do it now. And I think it's a great idea, because you know, the purpose of reciting the Patimokkha is to remind you of the rules, to remind you what's going on. It's not just, it shouldn't be an empty ritual, in my opinion. It's a great, great opportunity to use it properly. Yeah. Yes, Daniel.
Actually, I almost suggested
that after
this class, you know, like they usually chant in Pali. Oh, yeah. You actually sing in English, because that's instead of joy, when that happens.
Okay.
Even though we actually use it as an English. Okay. But yeah, both the after lunch, so is it the Buddha that suggested that after the meal, he gives a teaching, or is it something that came about? It's not actually laid down.
It's not laid down as a rule or anything like that. It's just the way things were done in those days. Yeah. And you know, you see that all the time in the suttas. They go and eat, and then they give a teaching. Sorry?
Does the Buddha encourage that?
Well, he doesn't actually say. He just that the way it was done. Yeah.
So why don't we do it then tomorrow? I know you sort of said it. Yeah. I think there's like a lot of praise.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I think that got around, and you know, the suggestive flow at that time. I don't know what's going on now, but at that time it was very much praise.
Yeah.
So what's stopping us, you know, tomorrow instead of
Yeah, I like to do that sort of thing. I think it's great. I think it's very nice to do to be able to suit everything. But you know, the thing is that it's difficult. It's a complicated issue because many traditional Buddhists, they are used to getting a blessing after the meal. So they think something funny is going on if you don't give a blessing in the, you know, in the traditional way. So it is difficult. You know, you have to sort of you have to find a kind of a nice middle way in a sense. So maybe the middle way is to give a little bit of very short 2-minute Dhamma discourse, and also give a traditional blessing. Maybe combine the two. So you have to find that balance.
Little bit,
yeah. Yeah, that's great.
But
yeah.
I think Siddha reading is too high for some people.
Yeah, so, but a little bit of Dhamma anyway. It's nice. Yeah.
You know, a short course.
Yeah, I actually used, there are some suttas that are very simple and very short, four lines, you can do that. Explain.
That too.
Yeah. And I think the reason they do it in Dhammasara is because in Sri Lanka, it's a kind of tradition in Sri Lanka. They still do that in Sri Lanka. You can give a Dhamma discourse afterwards, yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's a good idea. But, you know, I do my thing when I'm sitting in the Bodhi seat. And then other monks do their thing when they're there. You know, that's just the way it's going to be there. Yeah. So, yes, thank you. Okay. And it's basically like a talk, is it? Yeah. Short talk, yeah.
For many people, I think they don't understand.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think it's great. I think it's really good. And I think sometimes also the people who are more traditional Buddhists, they come to the monastery every week. It's nice for them to sometimes hear a little bit of Dhamma. Mm-hmm. Because often they are so used to just being, you know, part of the community and offering something. Sometimes they have never really heard any Dhamma very often, you know. They don't get to hear it. So maybe sometimes they might be very grateful for hearing some proper teachings.
Not the Dhammaluka 1 hour.
Very short. Very short. Yeah. Good point, yeah.
I don't know, would you be up for it? If I had a wrong to tired or not into that, would you be up for giving a little 2-minute teaching?
At the mealtime?
Yeah.
I think you just have to do it. Ajahn Brahm has to do his thing, you know.
No, but that's for instance, like if we suggest that, could you,
Ajahn
Brahmani, give a little 2-minute reading of the Dhammapada or
something? I don't think that's appropriate. I think when he is the boss, that he has to do his thing, you know. I mean, if you want to, you can always talk to him if you want to suggest something. Suggest something, yeah.
I don't know if he's tired for it, or yeah. I don't feel bad bothering him.
Yeah. Ajahn Brahm is more like he's just there, he's just his presence, you know, and keeps you happy, and you know, that's kind of his way of doing things.
And he's inspiring just the way he is,
Yeah, exactly. So the rest of us, we have to be inspiring by some of the Buddha's teachings. Yeah. Rishi.
Is there any sort of evidence that we have about sort of, because I know the Buddha was, you know, like against the Vedic tradition, or not against it, you know, but sort of the idea of like venerating just ceremonies of ceremonies and religious texts, so that's only a certain few could understand. But then in a way that happened with Buddhism to an extent, like with Pali chanting. And, when did that start happening?
I think it happened probably pretty much right away, you know. But this is so much easier. I mean, giving a talk can be quite hard and difficult because you have to, you know, you have to think maybe a little bit about what you're going to say. You have to structure it in a nice way. It has to sort of come out nicely. But just chanting a kind of standard formula is a much easier thing to do. Yeah? So it probably happened quite fast after the Buddha passed away. Yeah? So it's, things tend to move towards the easy thing. Yeah? That's the way the world works. So, I think it's just natural. It's natural. There's nobody to blame, really. It's just in the nature of things, how things work. Yeah. Okay, let's finish off the last paragraph. Just as a woman or a man, young, youthful, fond of adornments, with head bathed, having received a garland of lotuses, jasmine, or roses, would take it with both hands and place it on the head. So too, there are clansmen who have gone forth out of faith, and etc., etc., have all these good qualities, who are not drivelers. These, on hearing the Venerable Sariputta's discourse on the Dhamma, drink it in and eat it, as it were, by word and thought. Good indeed it is that he makes his fellows in the holy life emerge from the unwholesome and establish themselves in the wholesome. Thus it was that these two great beings, as a Mahanaga, rejoiced in each other's good words. Okay, any last questions?
What do you think that is included in the Pali? Because, you know, it's not
the first
word. Why did they recite this in the
Why is it included?
Yeah, why is it included?
I think there are many reasons, but I think one reason why there are many suttas by Sariputta is that he was specifically sent by the Buddha to be the one. If there was one monk who could continue the Buddha's dispensation apart from the Buddha himself, it was Sariputta, specifically said by the Buddha. I think from that already you would automatically include what he said, because you know the Buddha said that he is virtually equivalent to himself. I think that's one reason. And another reason is simply that, remember the in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the Buddha lays down the four great standards on what is a discourse, what is a proper discourse. And in there he said that if the discourse fits with what is already exists in the suttas, what already exists in the Vinaya, then it is equivalent to discourse spoken by the Buddha. He doesn't quite say that, because what it actually says is that if somebody claims that this is the word of the Buddha, then you should compare that with what is already in the suttas. So, but I would actually say that my opinion, this might be very strict, but the Buddha does say elsewhere in the Anguttara Nikaya, he says that in the future, one of the dangers for the decline of the Dhamma, and I think this is a very important point, he says that in the future people will not listen to the profound word of the Buddha anymore. Instead, they will listen to the word of, and he talks about bahirikas, outsiders, kaveyas, which are poets. Is poetry beautiful? People are interested in poetry. And then lastly, samvakas, which are disciples. They will listen to these rather than listening to the profound word of the Buddha. So I would say, because many of these monks, some of these monks who give discourses actually are samvakas, so if there is any doubt about what they say in the suttas, so if you think that maybe it's not quite, doesn't fit with something, you have the right to say that this I shouldn't take my stand on this, I should take my stand on what is considered the word of the Buddha. So that is actually acceptable, I think. So, any last questions? Everybody happy? Yeah? Okay.